Arguments 9. Evil from human nature. To traditional believers, we have said the problem of evil cannot be solved by applying ever stronger, ever blinder faith. To atheists, we have said, explain the problem of good if you can, not in remote and naturalistic terms only, like kin selection or inclusive fitness, but in experiential and existential terms. The theology of theopraxy, we have also said, does not need to solve the problem of evil, because it does not believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing Creator God in the first place. And it goes on to throw some light on the atheist's problem of good. Nonetheless, we can ask, can our theology offer something useful about the practical problem of evil, that is, about the presence of evil in everyday life? On the definition of good offered in Explanations 6, the theology of theopraxy sees evil, which is good's opposite, as the free and conscious doing of harm, where harmful, or harm, is what we call whatever action destroys, dishonors, or diminishes any form or instance of life whose thriving does not depend on harming equal or higher forms and instances of life. Extending this, we can say, particular forms and instances of life that want more life for all forms and instances of life, with the proviso above, are apt to do right and good, while particular forms and instances of life that want less life for all forms and instances of life, or more life only for themselves, or their form of life, are apt to do wrong or evil. What is not alive, however, or does not want, that is, desire anything, might be good or bad for life, and we can decide which, but it cannot do or be evil. The nearby supernova that will someday scatter our solar system through the infinite space like so much dust will be bad, very bad for life on Earth, but it will not be evil. Is evil an entity or force? St. Augustine, Maimonides, Aquinas, and most liberal theologians since have disavowed the idea that evil is a positive force or entity, usefully personified as Satan or the Prince of Darkness. Rather, they say, evil is a privation, an absence, a lack of goodness. They reject the Gnostic notion that Yahweh is a lesser God, as well as the Manichaean notion that agents of good and evil, cosmic in scale and equal in power, are locked in eternal battle with each other. Why do they reject these hypotheses? Probably because it does no good to believe them. Less good, anyway, than believing in the far greater power and ultimate triumph of a God who is wholly good. But if we agree that the word evil means something more than the failure to do good when it would be possible to do good, or to prevent harm when it would be possible to prevent harm, if evil means positively, in some sense, visiting pain and anguish and death upon others, then we must admit to some slippage, some contamination by older notions of evil as a, quote, positive force. For it implies that evil is more than just nature's entropy at work in the form of error or randomness, breakage, aging, or natural death, and more than just a thwarting of good intentions by complications. Evil that deserves the name is wrongdoing intended, done, and condoned. It is someone's wishing harm upon another and then acting in ways that bring it about, ways that might include neglect or carelessness, that is, forms of not doing. It also speaks of evil's attractiveness, of the way that evil doing can tell us to do things in the name of justice, a little fun, or short-term gain in an uncertain world. Definitions can get us only so far. What can be said about the practical problem of evil from the point of view of theopraxy? In the most preliminary of analyses, this, that evil occurs chiefly as the result of four features of human nature. The first feature is that people can be driven by the conditions of war, famine, addiction, sickness, poverty, imprisonment, or natural disaster to regress to a less than human state. Starved or threatened or cornered, people will kill to save their own lives or the lives of their clan. Humiliated, they will strike out to restore their dignity. They will steal, deceive, and destroy, or in despair do away with themselves, which is hardly a better outcome. It's obvious how to prevent evil in these cases, at least in theory. It is to do everything possible to prevent humanity-degrading conditions from developing in the first place. And if the situation is already far gone, it is to do everything possible to reverse them. Now, some might say, not everyone turns to evil under duress. Good people don't. People of strong faith don't. Only the morally weak blame their situations. Is this true? Well, we can certainly find instances that illustrate the case. But setting aside the evidence that tells us that chance and genetic factors make a significant contribution as to who will break and who will not, let us remember to check the intentions of those who push this only the weak fail argument to the fore. Because aside from being logically circular, it can be used to persuade others to allow themselves to be tested to failure and then to blame themselves for having characterological flaws such as weakness of faith or evolutionary unfitness, and to do this all to the persuader's advantage. Even on the best of motivations, relying on extraordinary conscience, courage, or faith in God is not a good idea. Human beings are social animals, flexible and ambitious. This is why, in the act of writing laws or configuring institutions whose overall missions might unquestionably be good, it is still essential to avoid devising jobs, positions, titles, roles, or patterns of authority that by their very nature will put people in situations of despair. Or, more insidiously, that will put people in situations where being good at their job is at odds with, or even disconnected from, doing good. The desire to be competent and be recognized as such, the desire to excel and deserve praise, runs strong in human nature. Regardless of the activity at hand, there are few stronger threats to our personhood, from ourselves if not others, than feeling incompetent, ineffective, unable to attract attention or to hold up our end. And this makes it easy and even natural for us to put being good at something ahead of whether that something is a good thing to do. Indeed, many people would rather be good at doing bad than be bad at doing good. All the more is this true when our competence at doing X, rather than the goodness of X, has been so configured institutionally as to be the source of our legitimacy or our livelihood. Lest you feel immune from this weakness, know that the nicest of us are capable of doing evil on this basis. The experiments of Stanley Milgram in the 1960s and Philip Zimbardo in the 1970s have made that abundantly clear. Not to mention the Nuremberg trials of the late 1940s or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of the 1990s. God is the good we do. God is therefore interested, metaphorically, selfishly interested, in how good we are at doing good. Other religious philosophers are able to make this claim too, of course, but none place the distinction at the heart of a theology. The second feature of human nature that keeps us prone to evil is this, that only witnessing suffering firsthand evokes in us the undismissible visceral responses of pity, empathy, or fear. Use remote means of warfare, and the enemy becomes unreal. Hide abattoirs, and we can all eat meat. Remove people of type C from our neighborhoods, and their fate becomes academic. One of the drawbacks of continuing suburbanization, globalization, and technological advance has been the heightened production of just this sort of social distance. Whole new classes of people whose lives do not intersect with ours in any direct way, whose faces, if they appear at all, appear on TV. Then, too, the consequences of our actions, mediated as they are by scores of people, machines, market transactions, and bureaucratic protocols, fan away in all directions, becoming ever harder to discern and harder to assign. Under these conditions, moral accountability is diffuse. When everyone is rationally doing their part in some great system with a capital S, no one person is responsible for the harm done, or the good done, for that matter. It is ever to the credit of conventional theistic preaching, therefore, that it emphasizes our personal visibility and accountability to God. We are each to follow God's commandments, each to treat others as we would like to be treated, each to resist attempts to make others alien, either by social definition or forced relocation. The theology of theopraxy goes one step further. It holds that God is the good we do, not collectively as such, as in democratically making good law, but individually as we each contribute to that process. Whenever and wherever good is being done, solo or in contribution to a collective effort, then and there is God summoned up, whole in every part. Every single encounter with others creates the potential for bringing God into being, or if you prefer, for bringing God's goodness to life. This view of God, I suggest, undoes tendencies to sacralize community per se, which many religions do, completely convinced in the case of their communities of its inherent morality. But in fact, taken too far, elevating community to religious status cultivates social distance from other groups, which sooner or later breeds enmity as well as bends individual conscience to community norms. A third fact about human nature, seldom remarked upon as a source of evil, is that people are prone to overcommitting to the ideal of justice. Consider this. Those who lie, steal, murder, and wreck others' lives in large and small ways invariably have a story to tell. And invariably, it is a story of injustice, redress, and/or higher justice. They did it because their victim killed their brother. They did it because they were unfairly fired. They did it because they needed the money more than the insurance company did. They did it because their family was stolen from. They did it because their rights were ignored, because they didn't get what others got and didn't deserve either, and so forth and so on. The list is long because, in fact, unfairness and injustice are endemic to life on earth. Life's complexity is such that it cannot be lived with precise and inflexible rules of fairness accounting. Without forgiveness or patience or hope, without doubt about the accuracy of hearsay, and without the capacity to absorb a modicum of unfair punishment and bad luck uncomplainingly, the grounds for evil doing are laid again and again. Is 9/10 of love not relaxed accountancy? Far from ignoring justice, repeated wrongdoers, bad people we might call them, are often perfectionists of justice, untutored that goodness is the higher ideal by far. What greater priority can be given good doing than identifying it with God Himself? Finally, a fourth fact about human nature. We are only recently out of the tribal phase of human existence, where, among other things, we imagine members of other religions or nations, i.e. tribes, to be blood-related to each other, and therefore intimately knowledgeable of each other's doings. Deeper than that, we imagine them united under the skin, each individual being simply a mirror or a manifestation of the archetypal person of that tribe. An Arab, a Jew, a Pole, a Catholic, an American. it follows that to encounter one actual person of that descent or origin is to encounter all people of that descent or origin collectively, archetypally. It is upon this atavistic logic that the guilt of one Greek, say, becomes the guilt of all Greeks, and punishing any Greek becomes only marginally second best to punishing the actual Greek that committed the offense. One might cite the shadow that fell upon all American Muslims after September 11, 2001. But history is replete with internments, discriminations, and pains inflicted upon the innocent through the idea of national character and collective guilt. And let us be wary, too, of the latter's seductive twin, collective merit. Now, to deny that there is any such thing as national character seems foolhardy. It would be to deny the role of culture, language, local history, and family ties in making the people of a given time and region similar to each other, for better and for worse, as well as more likely, however slightly, to know each other. Nor can one deny that at first meeting between strangers compellingly involves each party making suppositions about the other's character based on their apparent nationality or social class. The sin, the crime, begins when matters stop there and no greater depth is sought or even admitted to exist. When the daily encounter between flesh and blood people devolves to or rises no higher than a game-like encounter between two stereotyped national characters, the potential for evil is hugely multiplied. An attitude barely appropriate to soldiers at war is being allowed to invade daily discourse. This is how brutality comes to lurk just below the surface of smiles. All this is well understood, and I shall not elaborate further. The question is, does the theology of theopraxy help us commit to seeing beyond national and cultural stereotypes to the more complex truth of the individual? I suggest that it does, by locating God in acts by individuals, acts in behalf of all life. God can be on no nation's side ever, by definition. Nations don't act, people do. It is you or not, you and I, who can choose to be, quote, on God's side or not, moment by moment. It is you and I who, to the best of our abilities, can help draft laws and construct situations wherein the good is rewarded and easier to do than the bad, or if not easier, still well short of requiring heroism. Learning to treat no person as a national or ethnic or cultural or racial type for longer than 1 second, which is about as much time as human nature can be granted in this case, is a small but important step. In summary, these four features of human nature have to be faced by all concerned with decreasing evil in the world. 1. Our tendency to regress in maturity and morality when under physiological duress or when attempting to satisfy inherently conflicted situational requirements. 2. Our insensitivity to remote suffering. 3. Our tendency to prioritize justice over goodness. And 4. Our tendency to relate to people as types. Others have written more eloquently about these things, but I know of no place where these four features of human nature are collected for inspection, nor, of course, a place where a response is offered from the point of view of a theology like ours. Secular humanists certainly would agree that although all four might be part of human nature, and indeed might once have served a life-preserving purpose, each, then as now, is brought forth and then exacerbated or moderated by human culture. And this means that each can be addressed by institutional design and by education. Education not only about the facts of history and nature, but about the varieties and consequences of our beliefs. One important set of beliefs has to do with the nature of God. Attempts such as ours to reconceive what the word God means are attempts precisely on the one hand to undo the logical flaws and unethical outcomes of too enthusiastic a belief in a supernatural, justice-dealing, side-choosing creator God, and on the other, to weaken the demoralizing effects of denying that holiness can be produced and not just deludedly felt by human beings in contact with God by almost any definition. Atheistic humanism, I submit, is handicapped by its disregard of sensus divinitatis, our sense of the divine. This is as much a feature of human nature as any of I have listed, with the difference that it is entrainable to producing and sustaining goodness in copious amounts. For subscribers to the theology of theopraxy, you know what that means. It means producing and sustaining God. Arguments 10. Enthusiasm and extremism. Converse to the problem of evil, as I have noted, is the problem of good. The problem of how and why there is so much good in the world as there is, given the indifference of nature and the brutishness that still characterizes human beings. It is here that the theology of theopraxy shines, because it sees goodness not at creation and thence in decline, but as the youngest and weakest feature of the universe, still in ascent. Now, it is common to hear it said by Christians and Muslims that God is the source of all good and humankind the source of all evil. Judaism agrees, more or less, but it allows human beings to originate, truly originate, good as well as evil. We have within us, the rabbi said, urges to both good and evil. We can be sources of light, not just reflections of it, agents of change, not just puppets. Only in the theology of theopraxy, however, is God identified with goodness itself, as and when good characterizes the deeds of people free to do otherwise. Evil originates in humans, to be sure, and not in God, in whom it cannot occur by definition. As Augustine said, all that is good is God. And so, just as goodness experienced teaches us who or what God is, God contemplated helps us see what good is. Put another way, holding on to God in concept helps us bridge between occasions of seeing God in action, or enacting God ourselves. But human nature is such that the intuitive feel for God we get from experiencing goodness firsthand is often superior to the intellectual understanding of God we get by reading or by theological speculation alone. It follows, from God being the good we do, that if classical religious faith reliably yields goodness and prevents evil, then none of its fictions, contradictions, odd rituals, or imponderables are nonsensical. It follows, equally, that if humanistic or even nihilistic atheism reliably brings about goodness and prevents evil, then none of its denials of the existence of God amount to any reduction in the fullness of God's actuality. And it follows, finally, that if and where any other worldview is found to be better at producing good and preventing evil than the theology I'm calling the theology of theopraxy, then the theology of theopraxy, by its own criteria, would have to remove itself from consideration, at least at that time and place, and among those people. And remove itself happily, since there would be other philosophies which better prepared people for the very theopraxy that its theology aims at encouraging. History has shown, however, that theism, in the hands of its enthusiasts, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, has been no more reliable at producing goodness and preventing harm than atheism has been in the hands of its enthusiasts, especially when either was joined to political power. We cannot know whether adopting the perspective offered in this book would make things better or worse. This is what we need to find out. Could subscribing to the theology of theopraxy turn people towards doing harm, toward evil? We will reflect upon this important question for the rest of this chapter and over the next few. Now, some critics would blame neither theism nor atheism for the harms done on their logic, but only extreme enthusiasm for them. It's neither religious faith, they say, nor religious skepticism that does the harm, but extremism in the defense or execution of either. It's unfortunate, they go on, that the angry prophet tradition in Western religion encourages an intolerance of other gods so absolute that it can easily lead to an intolerance of the people who believe in other gods or in no god at all, as well as an impatience with, if not hatred, for any people whose styles of belief in the one God differ from theirs. Both Bible and Quran are rich with recountings of God's rewards to complete faith in Him expressed a right way, and of His punishment of incomplete faith in Him expressed in the wrong way, for example, through idolatry. "I am the way, the truth, and the life," said Jesus according to John in 14:6. "No man cometh unto the Father but by me." What could alienate Jews and later Muslims more? Allah is the one true God and Muhammad His only true prophet. What could alienate Christians and Jews more? "For thou art a holy people, and the Lord hath chosen thee above all nations that are upon the earth." That's Deuteronomy 14:2. What could alienate Christians and Muslims more? Atheism is far from innocent of extremism too, as Mao Zedong and Joseph Stalin proved. Atheists are often radical in their opposition to all religious faith, which they see as nothing more than exploitable superstition, the opiate of the masses, as Marx famously put it. Belief in God was so sure an indication of weak-mindedness that it needed to be stamped out like an unhealthy addiction. If we were not living at a time of conflicting religious fundamentalisms, in particular war and near war between Jewish-Christian fundamentalism with Jewish nationalism on the one hand and Islamic fundamentalism with pan-Arab nationalism and Islamism on the other, watched over by a multitude of atheists, agnostics, New Agers, deists, and secularists, powerless to effect reconciliation using purely humanistic or spiritual ideas, we would not need to spend the next 18 pages on the question. Indeed, the problem deserves 1,000 if they would help. But here is the important question for us. If extremism in the advancement of different forms of theism or atheism is the culprit, could the theology of theopraxy support an extremism of its own and thus go bad? For example, might a person become a good deed fanatic and do harm? Might some subscribers to our theology, believing themselves, mistakenly, to be God, go on justice-dealing rampages or figuratively drown themselves, like the legendary good King Canute, who moved his throne to the beach and commanded the tides to stop? And what if they have truly bad, in the sense of stupid, bad ideas about what good is? Well, forewarned is forearmed. But let us be hopeful, too. Might there be something in the DNA, as it were, of the theology of theopraxy that moderates extremism automatically? Could it help make peace among the adherents of different faiths? I think so. Arguments 11. How religions go bad. 1. A good framework for discussion is provided by Charles Kimball in his 2002 book, When Religion Becomes Evil. From a range of historical examples, Kimball adduces 5 warning signs that a religion is sanctioning, if not actively promoting, evil. Each sign, he notes, issues from an otherwise innocuous, even helpful, religious doctrine being pursued to extremes. Here are the 5 signs. When the religion in question starts, 1. Making absolute truth claims. 2. Advocating blind obedience. 3. Establishing an ideal time. 4. Believing that the end justifies any means. And 5. Declaring holy war. In this chapter, and over the next few, I will argue that the theology of theopraxy is less likely to exhibit any of these signs than the other 3 Abrahamic religions have been. Of course, theopraxy is not a religion, nor are there data to show how the theology of theopraxy as a set of ideas and maxims would develop in multiple hands and minds. But we should at least look for the seeds of trouble in the propositions upon which it rests. We start with Kimball's first sign, namely, making absolute truth claims. Thinking that one knows, or that one's leader knows or knew the absolute truth about God and what God wants from humanity, forms the foundation of all religious intolerance, which is to say the opinion that one's own religion is right and others wrong, one's own path true and the others false. Now, God is the good we do is an absolute truth claim, and so we are obliged to ask whether it could become a problem if taken to heart. The answer, I think, is no. We can believe absolutely that God is the good we do without believing absolutely that we know what the absolute best thing to do is, and we would disavow anyone who habitually or on God's authority said they knew beyond question what particular act now would be best. For the truth is that many alternative actions can be equally good in a given situation, and many actions good enough, especially given that one can never be sure of the long-run consequences of any action. One simply does one's level best, taking other people's opinions into account, and then tries to develop safety nets and plan Bs in case one turns out to be wrong. The theology of theopraxy also claims that doing good reliably, like maintaining a high batting average in baseball, is a skill that people can develop in different degrees. This advocates patience, as well as moderates expectations as to how much good any particular person can do. Luckily, all good doing is God. Big good doing, like saving 100 lives, and little good doing, like opening a door for a package-laden stranger. Expert good doing, like performing surgery on a newborn, and non-expert good doing too, like assuring a friend that she's not fat. Which is why God is all good, just as tradition has it. Alas, God is the good we do, the motto, could become fighting words, even with nobody claiming to know exactly what the good is. For example, conservative believers could see, correctly, that God is the good we do implies that God is only the good we do, and object strongly. They might tolerate that God is also the good we do, or in the good we do, but not only. Shall we remove the implicit only in God is the good we do and make them happy? They might also prefer God is in the good we do, as we said. Shall we put the in? No, in all cases. For such concessions would walk away from what the theology of theopraxy wants us to face, which is the untenability of believing God to be all good as well as all-knowing and all-powerful in any literal sense. Our theology asks people to see God's omniscience and omnipotence for what they are, not facts, but, as I often explanations 8, assertions evolved to magnify our subtler ethical intuitions, to endorse them, and to give us the courage to act upon them. To be sure, believing that God is all good, all knowing, and all powerful reduces the uncertainty we feel about our ethical judgments. When at a loss, we simply give over to God, invoking perhaps a passage from the Bible. We can let the consequences of our actions be taken out of our hands and put into God's, and so reduce our dread of regret. If we try for outcome X, but it does not come about, then God must not have wanted X to come about, and so it was the best that it did not. But we have to wonder, surely there are less metaphysically bedeviled and less exploitable ways to give ourselves the courage to do the right thing on the one hand, and to alert us to our limitations on the other. If maintaining that God is only the good we do could rile conservative believers, it could also rile atheists. Why bother with God, they could ask, when the God you believe in is so contingent, so unmighty, so human? We can reply, The reconciliation of faith with reason is of such importance, and the quest for it so old, that both theists and atheists should reconsider their premises. Believers should rethink what they mean by the word real and what they mean by the word God when they assert that God really exists. And atheists should do the same when they deny that God exists. The theology of theopraxy offers a middle way, a way for God to be real and also not real in a way, to exist and also to, quote, not exist. I believe that it can reconcile differences at a basic level for a good number of people. Finally, we should note that a quarrel between the theology of theopraxy on the one hand and both conservative theism and atheism on the other would only be theological, which is to say, only theoretical. For at the level of practical action, and in the vast majority of cases, the theology of theopraxy has no quarrel with what would count as good behavior for believers or atheists. After all, the identification and enumeration of human virtues is not unique to any single religion or philosophy, nor is the ideal of the love of life the love of all life. The way to avoid widening the conflict, therefore, is to concentrate on beliefs' outcomes, not beliefs' contents. This pragmatism is one that the theology of theopraxy shares with religions and philosophies as diverse as Judaism, Confucianism, utilitarianism, Zoroastrianism, ethical culture, and modern liberal democracy. No other religious philosophy, however, raises that pragmatism to the level of the holy. In the end, as at the beginning it says, God is the good we do, not someone or something whose existence we can only argue about. Arguments 12. How religions go bad, 2. Making absolute truth claims, continued. We still need to consider whether belief in the truth of such maxims as God is the good we do or God is in our hands could someday cause harm beyond provoking intellectual disagreement. Well, first consider this. An avid subscriber to the theology of theopraxy would have to be an existentialist and a romantic, a believer and a skeptic, a traditionalist and a revolutionary, all at once. This is a complex position to hold, to say the least, but it has the following advantage. Any tendency to extremism with regard to one of its components would be counteracted by a commitment to another component, likely its opposite. Our theology is self-moderating, some would say conflicted. Moreover, the complexity of thought involved does not lend itself to easy imitation and thus to rapid propagation in the general population. So far, so good and bad. The theology of theopraxy is for smart people. Alas, overly facile renditions of it could emerge nonetheless, renditions of it that might encourage extremism in certain people, and this would be unfortunate. Consider the following two scenarios, the first mostly an irritation, but the second potentially more dangerous. The first, do-goodism. The thought that one is doing God when one is doing good can be quite heady. Dizzy with the importance of their every action, some people could come to be annoying to live around, meddlesome, self-righteous, overly earnest, and critical. We call them do-gooders already, people who insist on doing what they think is the higher good at every turn, despite other possibilities and judgments. For example, friends and family members who refuse to ask for help when they need it because they don't want to be a burden, or think you should offer them help more genuinely. How about people who never park over a yellow line because it would be wrong? Or people who like running about in constant service to others, innocently spreading indebtedness, and so on. This is not to say that all do-gooders are responding to religious impulses. There are other reasons for behaving in this obsessively law-abiding, holier-than-thou way. but insistent do-goodism has at least this saving grace. It is self-limiting. For as soon as the insistence itself is understood as blocking or undoing the good intended, it stops in embarrassment. The mission might continue, but another way is sought. Live and let live becomes the more credible motto, at least until the next reminder. Add social authority to do-goodism, however, and one has paternalism of the most irksome sort. That is, permanent and with prima facie impeccably moral intentions of law on its side. And this can slide to our second extremism, hubris. Hubris is such arrogant, violent pride in one's own moral and creative powers, or if not one's own, then in one's tribe or humankind's, that it comes to rival or eclipse gods, as traditionally conceived. Hubris is no less dangerous in secular contexts. "I am France," cried de Gaulle, than it is in religious ones, where it is a blasphemy to presume oneself in any way to be God. But pointing to secular hubris is not yet a defense of theopraxy, and blasphemy is what every traditional Christian, Jew, or Muslim hears in epigrams like, "Whether or not God exists is entirely up to us," "God is the good we do," or "God is in our hands." How can their worries be assuaged? Only by knowing more. For let there be no mistake, the theology of theopraxy does not claim that any person can be God, or ever was God, or ever will be God, only that some of their deeds are, have been, and will be. When God is the good we do, no one can say, "I am God," or "we are gods," only that "I do God," or "we do God," happily allowing traditional believers to add, "will," God's will. Moreover, and more importantly, the God that subscribers to the theology of theopraxy believe that they and others bring into being with their good doings is not the all-powerful God of the Bible. Traditional believers are right. Human beings cannot be Lord over God and at the same time mean by God the Lord God of the Bible and Quran. But subscribers to the theology of theopraxy are right too. God, in their terms, has none of the biblical Quranic God's infinite powers and attributes in the first place. Powers and attributes that it would indeed be presumptuous, not to say dangerous, for any human being or group of human beings to claim for themselves. When God is believed to be nothing like the sun, nothing like a king or warrior or judge on high, or even the ground of being or some such ultimate thing, but rather more like a candle flame, a whisper of conscience, a tender gesture, a favor for a stranger, unreported and unremarked upon, a flow of deeds and thoughts as rippling and balanced as a dance upon water, what large thing is there for hubris to attach itself to? Then, too, believing that we all enact God equally when we do good does not make me very special or powerful. It makes me just another worker in the field, as it were, lifting the sparks. A theopracticing person saying, "I do good," and thereby make God, is rather like a musician saying, "I play the violin," and thereby make music. As I wrote in Declaration 7, wherever and whenever there is a choosing of good over bad, of beauty over ugliness, of truth over falsehood, and life over death, there is God, and only there, as fugitive as the moment, ready to become a reality enacted. God is in everyone's hands. In the theology of theopraxy, one might say, God is neither Father nor Son, but rather more like the Holy Spirit, or Shekinah, the divine presence that penetrates in forms and issues from the human heart, one situation and one deed at a time. But unlike the Holy Spirit or Shekinah, this Spirit, this presence, has no fountainhead, no radiant unitary source, no point in the beginning whence it emanated. Because of this, theopracticians do not imagine themselves connected to an all-powerful creator who works his will through them. Instead, they imagine themselves as modest but always significant sources of good themselves, like fireflies, God present and accounted for by every glowing deed. This is the good news of the theology of theopraxy. There are those who will say, this is all very nice, very poetic, but what you're describing is not God as anyone today understands the word. It is something else. Why don't you find a new name for it? God is taken. We can reply, there is no question of finding a new name for good being done. It is God. Our aim is precisely to challenge older ideas of God with newer ones, to contest the meaning of the name. Who, what, when, and how God really exists is the question that needs answering in a way that best produces what all believers in God say God wants: the end of involuntary suffering, more beauty, justice, and truth in the world, more enjoyment, peace, and goodwill among men and women and all living creatures, in a phrase, our continued evolution as a moral species. Arguments 13. How religions go bad. 3. We move on now to examining the theology of theopraxy for the second of Kimball's warning signs that a religion is turning to evil, namely, advocating blind obedience. As Kimball points out, when any person, ideology, institution, government, or business begins to demand blind obedience, the potential for evil doing is greatly multiplied. Now, obedience is far from rare, even in freedom-loving America. It's demanded from soldiers in the army. It's required from patients in hospitals, students at school, employees on the job, and drivers on the road. But these kinds of obedience are sighted, we might say, rather than blind, because their ends, survival, health, education, a salary, and safety, are objectively measurable and endorsed by those who obey. But the obedience that certain religious sects, for example, demand from their followers tends to be of a different sort, not just because the ends are often unconfirmable, for example, reward in heaven, but because the obedience has a different purpose, namely, to conceal the weakness and exploitative intentions of the institution's leaders, or to deflect attention from contradictions in its governing doctrine. Moreover, unlike other forms of obedience, the boundaries of religious obedience are not clear. What would or should one not do for God? What heinous act cannot be framed as a test of faith? Certainly, when trust in leadership becomes so great that facts about it which would normally be disturbing are dismissed, or when submission to irrational doctrine is demanded as a payment for the social material benefits of membership, one has the very formula for blind obedience, and this can lead to disaster. There is a parallel distinction between rational faith and irrational faith. Rational faith is a positive response to uncertainty when a decision must be made whose outcomes can and will be judged. Irrational faith that systematically ignores or denies contrary indications, that legitimizes irrationality in principle, and or that precipitates outcomes that cannot, will be judged. This is irrational faith. The two obediences, sighted and blind, usually follow from the two types of faith. Sighted obedience from rational faith, and blind obedience from irrational faith. I want to argue that the theology of theopraxy, insofar as it involves faith, involves rational faith, and insofar as it asks for obedience, it asks for sighted obedience. How so? The faith that the theology of theopraxy asks for is rational because it privileges knowing over believing when knowledge is available, and because it submits itself to judgment of the consequences of belief. If one's beliefs about God do not issue in better actions than otherwise, then it is wrong belief, not just morally, but also scientifically. Thus, one can be a theopracticing Jew or a theopracticing Christian, a theopracticing Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, or Jain. One can attend services, read sacred texts, sing, pray, light candles, kneel, meditate, even preach, because one judges on the available evidence that these are morally creative acts constitutive of the God they nominally serve. An understanding of the theology of theopraxy might allow people to embrace their home religions in a deeper and more existential way than they were capable of before. This embrace would not be a simple return to the faith or born-againness. For once one has understood the meaning of theopraxy, once one has glimpsed its theological implications, one is unlikely to practice one's religion naively, without interpretation. Its precepts will have become true in a different, richer way. Goodness of deed will have become the point, not doctrinal correctness. Actions in everyday life will count, not avowals of faith on special occasions, nor fluency in prayer, nor practicedness in ritual. Subtlety of conscience begins to matter, not degree of moral conviction. Knowledge of the world, not just knowledge of one's trade and the Bible or Quran. With the theology of theopraxy showing the way, one finds oneself living and breathing the ethical core of the religion in question and being watchful for its corruption. One finds oneself loving its peculiar, time-soaked images and stories for how they encourage us to protect, promote, and dignify all life, while being wary of those images and stories that do not, and many Bible stories do not. One sees religion's rituals as demonstrations of the joy and solemnity of the ethical life, as shapers of community, tolerant of other communities, as mechanisms for commitment and recommitment to virtue, as expressions of gratitude for life itself, as reminders for what is at stake. And one remains watchful that these performances, otherwise of no worth, do not de-evolve into rote or pageantry for its own sake. Now, going to the mosque because it's Friday, going to the synagogue because it's Saturday, or church because it's Sunday, represents sighted, not blind, obedience. The compulsion is gone. In its place is self-determination. In all great undertakings, wrote Paul Valéry, tradition, in the true sense of the word, does not consist of doing again exactly what others have done before, but in recapturing the spirit that went into what they did and would have done differently in a different age.